Today on the Wine Scholar Guild podcast, we are chatting with Andrew Jefford, award-winning author and columnist for Decanter and World of Fine Wine. My name is Valerie Caruso. I'm a wine educator and podcast host, and I am so excited to talk with Andrew again, who has just joined the Wine Scholar Guild team as academic advisor. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Valerie. Great to talk to you again.
I know this is so exciting, and you have a new position now, so let's go ahead and start there. As a journalist and webinar presenter and immersion trip leader, your new position as academic advisor certainly does complement the other roles in the wine world that you take on. But how does this actually reflect your own personal wine education philosophy? Or would you say it's the other way around?
Well, no, my education philosophy is really pretty simple. It's got two strands to it, I guess. The first strand is that pretty much everything is interesting. And the second strand is that you never know everything. You're always learning. And so any kind of educational initiatives I can make are a wonderful privilege for me. I've always enormously enjoyed the interaction I've had with the students of Wine Scholar Guild, the travel I've done with them, the wine study tours, all of that kind of stuff. So it's really a complete pleasure. And I guess also the educational work is quite a good complement to the journalistic work. The journalistic work is it's really very time intensive if you want to do it properly. You've got to travel a lot. And yet, as far as journalism goes, the work only really begins when you finish traveling, when you get home and you start writing. And then personally, I find writing, at least writing well, is a very slow process. You have to work slowly. You have to kick yourself regularly to make sure that you're keeping everything up to scratch. You've got to revise everything, check everything. In a way, the educational work is, I would say, more direct. You can research, you can communicate, you can interact with subjects, you can interact with students. And as I say, it's a lovely complement to the journalistic work. And I stressed just now, you know, the fact that you're always learning. And I think it's very important by that to say that I don't just mean, you know, acquiring new facts and figures and details, learning new stuff. Of course, that's true. But what I'm also thinking a lot about the last few years is that, you know, you can get things wrong. You can reach erroneous conclusions about things. And personally, I find kind of changing my mind about things is very satisfying. Let me just give you a couple of quick examples of that. And here's the first one. You know, if you're schooled in the French way of thinking about terroir, you end up kind of according an enormous amount of importance to soils. And that's not illogical when you're looking at top French wine producing regions, in that once you've found a great place to make wine, then the difference between the various wines you can produce there, at least in theory, i.e. before the winemaker has stepped forward with his or her own foibles, often relates to soils or soils plus topography. The Burgundy example is the classic one there. You know, in a single Burgundian village, it is very much soil and topography that makes the difference between those village wines and the Premier Cru and the Grand Cru. But then, you know, once you step back and begin to look at all the places around the world where you could make wine, and you begin to search for the differences between them, then soils, for example, become much less important and sometimes almost completely irrelevant. You know, it's climate, macro, meso, micro, that's really far more important than soil as a what we could call a general differentiator of vineyard sites, and topography too. You know, the basic measure of comparison between all the world's wine sites should certainly be climatic. And I don't think we're ever going to begin to make sense of terroir until every significant vineyard around the world has got an identical ISO weather station whose data is handled and recorded and logged in an identical ISO way. And until we can sort of establish trustworthy growing degree day totals for each site, that's really sort of step one in understanding terroir. And we're still nowhere near that. We're still decades away from that. So a huge amount of what we say about terroir, in a way, is complete guesswork and wildly unscientific, despite all the mountains of stuff there is out there about soils and rocks. And I've only really realized that fully, I think, in the last couple of years. And then just to mention one other thing that, you know, again, is I'm revising my opinions on, you know, it's to do with varietal plantings around the world. We tend to accept that, you know, we almost have the best of all possible worlds in terms of varietal plantings, but I'm now coming around to thinking that actually we're performing way, way below full potential. What we tend to do is plant the varieties whose names have a commercial significance, whose names have a sale function, but they're not necessarily the varieties that the vineyard really wants us to plant. And, you know, to really plant those varieties, we'd need to do 50 years more research almost everywhere. Merlot, for example, is the second most widely planted wine grape around the world, 266,000 hectares. And yet outside Bordeaux and Tuscany, it's almost a complete waste of vintage time, since it often doesn't make beautiful or expressive wines. So I'm now coming around to thinking that if every Merlot vineyard around the world was ripped up and replanted with 20 different varieties to find out what truly worked well there, and then we took a couple of decades to study the results, then we could really make great leap forwards in terms of quality. Will it ever happen? Can it ever happen? Of course not. So I rather sort of despair that we're ever going to get there in anything under 300 to 500 years. But anyway, that's just another example of something that I'm, you know, increasingly thinking about and revising my opinions on. And that really, I think, is a very important part also of education. The revision of one's opinions.
I was just going to say that. I think you've kind of answered my next question, because being a wine writer, your perspectives on the wine world is so much broader than those of us who just kind of put our nose in a book and kind of study. And personally, when it comes to learning, I found research is very important. That's how I learn. I learn by writing papers and making mistakes. And I think everybody listening to this is going to have to find the way they learn. And revising your opinions and revising the way you see the wine world is so important. So I would say that sounds like what you're most excited about.
Yeah, thinking it through for yourself, that is the really important thing. And always, you know, in your tasting, in your thinking, in your discovering, in your traveling, always never taking anything for granted, rethinking everything.
So there are different, you've already touched on climate, and listeners, I think if you go back and listen to the Burgundy episode where polar vortex actually made its appearance in there, and we talked about climate change, it was pretty exciting. But the industry is also a part of the wine world that you are very dug into, and a lot of listeners also are in the industry, a lot of the members. So how does the industry balance that out, that natural, like you were talking about, the way we change the grapes we grow and the way wines are actually made to express either the sense or place, or what is the industrial aspect or appeal and the changing market demands that we all have to get our heads around when studying these regions?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're quite right to put a lot of emphasis on the human aspect. You know, if we go back to the idea of terroir itself, I mean, terroir is nothing really more than a kind of ghostly dream, you know, utterly hidden in a landscape until the human being comes along. It's human beings that make terroir happen, or they don't. They can repress it or steamroller it. But it's, you know, humans are always the catalyst for terroir, so that the human interaction is incredibly important. There's no doubt that, you know, tastes are evolving in that kind of respect. The way, the kind of thing, you know, the kind of things that humans are doing with wine. I mean, just take it as one example, look at the role of oak. I mean, 20 years ago, I'm sure you remember too, although probably that's, you know, you're not as old as I am. But, you know, I remember very well that 20 years ago, palpable oak was really a kind of key quality trigger. And now it's almost become a sort of sign of failure. So that's a very glaring example of how tastes have changed. And that's an important and essential process. I think also we tend to now have a better understanding of classicism, of restraint and refinement, which from great sites anyway really constitutes a kind of enduring aesthetic benchmark. On the industrial side of things, I mean, people often knock industrial wine, but, you know, we need industrial wine. Not everybody wants to spend, you know, high proportions of their income on wine. It's an economic necessity. But I do think that, you know, I'm always a little bit wary of that phrase, the wine industry, because to me, you know, wine is agriculture and agriculture is not industry. The moment you have agriculture, you have change, you have variability, you have seasonal change, you have change from place to place, you have, you know, change related to place. Industry is all about creating the same thing over and over again. And although you can apply that to wine, really, whenever you get to more interesting wines, finer wines, good wines, greater wines, you're always talking about agriculture. So it's very important never to forget that agricultural side of winemaking too.
So maybe it would be more appropriate to say the business of wine, because there are many aspects of the business of wine. There's the education aspect, there's the sales aspect, the distribution, you know, the production, the enological, viticultural aspects. Would you say that'd be more appropriate then?
Yes, yes. I think that's a much better way of looking at it, actually, for sure.
The business of wine. Yeah. So all your newsletters, change your titles.
Well, the other thing is, in French, they always say filiale, the network. And actually, you know, when I hear the wine industry, the phrase I always want to replace it with is wine creation in general. Because, you know, even if you're making, Yellowtail or Blossom Hill, you're still involved in creation to some extent. And I think the more we can emphasize that creative aspect, a sort of creative partnership with nature, the better.
You're creating not just a product, you're creating moments as well. You're creating a scene that people are setting in their minds when they're buying that bottle as well. They're not just going in and saying, oh, yeah. Just,
no. Yeah, absolutely. Because wine is one of the most emotional purchases we ever make.
Absolutely.
That's why it has its kind of complete power over us. And that should never be forgotten. That's very important.
Well, I like how you said how it has power over us, because I'm just going to shift here into another set of questions before we get back into the wine chatter here. You already answered the if you were a wine, which wine would you be and why question in episode 9. So I would actually like you to share that moment, that experience that you realized you were going to plant your professional roots, pun intended, in the world of wine.
You know, these things don't necessarily happen with one axial moment. I mean, I do remember when I was at university, you know, having lunch with some people that I was living with at the time. And, you know, I remember there was a bottle of Beaujolais on the table. And I remember, you know, that I was staying with some people who were really heavily into, you know, cooking. They really took put a lot of effort into cooking, but they didn't care too much about the wine. And I remember sitting at the table and thinking, yeah, they put a lot of effort into this meal and it's very good, but the wine, and it was only a Beaujolais, you know, the wine was really so much better. So, you know, I would say wine always kind of spoke to me in a way, perhaps the food never did. So that was quite significant. I do remember another key moment when I was, I forget exactly when it was, if I was looking for work or if I was getting to the end of my studies, or I think I was looking for a job by that stage. And I, you know, it was the first time I bought Decanter magazine, and I read a bit of it, you know, and I saw there were some columns and things. And I remember thinking, well, you know, I could do that. So those were kind of the seeds. But actually, as far as putting down roots are concerned, that's a different matter. And in many ways, I would say that I'm still not that rooted in wine compared to some people I know. I'm not particularly part of any establishment. I'm not a geek. I don't eat, breathe, and sleep wine. I don't have a fantastic wine collection. I don't go to a lot of fancy wine dinners. I have friends who are wine growers, and I greatly value their friendship, but I don't spend all my time with them, and I don't spend all my time with wine journalists either. So I don't really particularly feel myself to be part of a wine establishment. And in fact, in some ways, you know, I feel I have a lot in common with Wine Scholar Guild students, because, you know, Wine Scholar Guild students are often distance learners. And in some ways, I feel like I'm a kind of lifelong distance learner who's had a lot of opportunities to go out there and do, as it were, study trips time after time after time for my journalistic work. But, you know, I still feel a little bit separated from that world. And I think actually that's quite a good thing for journalism too, maybe even a good thing for academic work as well, to maintain a sense of distance and objectivity between you and the subject. If you get so wrapped up in it that you're eating, breathing and sleeping it, you won't have that that objectivity and that distance, which I think is quite important.
You also won't have friends.
Well, you'll have other friends like you.
So I think that is an interesting perspective as well, because I did stalk that essay on your website, and you actually waxed quite philosophical about the way you approach wine. So even though I said you're dug in, I think many of us do consider you a fixture in the wine writing world, in the wine writing industry. So I think a lot of us may be surprised to know that you don't eat, drink, and breathe it and sleep it like, you know, some of us might think we do, but I personally am not in the business of wine myself. I just like wine education and that is it. So I think that was, thank you for sharing that. That was a very personal perspective that I think the listeners will be really happy to hear.
Yeah. And, you know, just quickly while we're on that, Valerie, I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, I get people coming up to me and saying, well, have you got, you know, tips for young wine writers and all the rest, you know, wine writing tips. And I always say to them, you know, number one, don't read too much wine journalism. Do not do that, because you'll just end up writing like everybody else and thinking like everybody else. You know, what you need to do is discover it for yourself. You need to have that personal experience. And then you need to write about it in as fresh a way as possible. And the best thing to read in order to do that is writing on all sorts of other subjects. See the way other people write about things that they have just discovered or they're discovering or that mean a lot to them. And then personalize that and put that into your wine writing, but don't spend a lot of time reading other wine writing. It's the worst thing you can do.
I kind of agree with that too. I think it, you have to vary, you know, what you read, what you consume, because otherwise you might get stuck in a paradigm. So that kind of brings me to the next question about the biggest change in the way wine is actually written about or discussed since you got into this, what, back 30, 40 years ago, right?
Yep, 32 years ago, something like that. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Well, I think there have been two really colossal changes. And the first is, of course, you know, the internet, the web, which has changed all of our lives in so many respects. We're only just beginning to realize to what extent it is changing our lives. And as far as, you know, wine is concerned, I mean, it has democratized the act of writing, not just about wine, about all sorts of other things. But it has rendered, you know, the act of writing a very democratic one. Anybody can be a web writer or a blogger. You just turn on your computer and start typing. And in fact, wine, you know, is a wonderful hobby for many people. And many of those for whom it is a hobby, you know, somehow feel inspired to write about it. So simply, there's just vastly more writing about wine in general now than there was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, you know, the people who wrote about wine were so-called experts in inverted commas. In other words, you know, for better or worse, long-term wine professionals or trained journalists. And of course, another thing, you know, another thing that goes along with that is that, you know, the life of the wine writer, at least from the outside, seems to be such an attractive one that people who have private means or other sources of income often do it for free as a kind of lifestyle choice. And so there's, you know, there really is, I would say, vastly more wine writing offer than there is actually wine writing demand. In a way, it's a kind of world of rampant inflation in that respect. And, you know, the standard of wine writing is pretty variable, as you'd expect from an inflationary environment. But there's a lot of creativity out there. It's not a negative thing at all. And of course, from the point of view of wine producers, it's wonderful. If your family business is producing steel rivets, nobody's ever going to write about you in the weekend newspapers and the glossy magazines. Whereas if you're making wine, you know, you have people queuing upside your door to come and talk to you and write all about the experience. So that's a colossal change, the arrival of the web. And then the other big one really is wine criticism as opposed to wine writing. You know, when I began 30 years ago, I mean, Parker was just getting going. He got going in the 1980s, most famously with, you know, his comments on the 82 Bordeaux vintage. I started in 88. I remember when I started, I'd never heard of Parker, but the first ever wine lunch I went to, which was with Cristiano Vanzella, who was looking after Quinta de Naval in Portugal at the time. And, you know, Robert Parker's name came up and somebody mentioned Bob Parker. And I remember Cristiano saying, Bob Parker, you mean God Parker? Because he'd already become very influential. So that was the arrival of criticism. It kind of coincided with me getting into this whole thing. And in general, you know, it's been a good thing. It's brought a certain rigor to wine tasting and assessment. But I have to say, I'm beginning to have, you know, some reservations about it as well now. I mean, obviously, there's the whole problem of scores.
Yes.
Scores, you know, they are necessary. They are appreciated by potential purchasers. I don't want to say they serve no value. They do serve a value. But, you know, philosophically, they are stupid and they cause a lot of damage, since they encourage people to think that the assessment of wine quality is 100% objective, which it isn't, and it can never be. You know, you and I know, There are you know, many 88-point wines which are better than many 93-point wines. For my palate or your palate or anybody's palate, because they come from a different region or because they come from a less fashionable grape variety or, you know, because they're made for drinkers rather than tasters or because it's a wet, cold Tuesday rather than a nice, sunny, warm Saturday. All sorts of things. The reality of wine is that it's irredeemably subjective. And so, you know, criticism has put too much emphasis on scores, and that overall is a bad thing. And of course, you know, there's now so much wine criticism. A lot of the quality of the whiting is just, you know, a lot of it to me now reads as if it's produced by robots or artificial intelligence or something. You get the same descriptors, you get the same key phrases churned out. There's a lot of kowtowing to existing hierarchies. You know, I've rather backed away from reading it, to be honest. And, you know, a lot of it, that was never true when Parker was, you know, in his heyday. You always felt that he really believed what he wrote. He could also surprise with his assessments. He backed complete outsiders. He knocked established wines, maybe not so much towards the end of his career, but certainly when he was establishing his reputation. In other words, there was a sort of authenticity and an urgency about his criticism, which I really find quite hard to find now. So I'm a little bit, you know, backing away from it. But, you know, like I say, if you're a sommelier who's looking to buy older wines or something like that, or if you're a wealthy but inexperienced wine, you know, new lover looking to spend $5,000 on the 2016 Bordeaux, yeah, criticism remains useful, of course. And, you know, you'll only really learn how stupid points are once you've bought a few high point wines and been disappointed by them.
Absolutely. And I know many people who've done that, which is why I don't typically post. I don't score wines and I don't critique wines. And, you know, if you want my tasting notes, I'll be happy to provide them. But it's my experience that I'm having. You may not have the same experience. You might be having a different food. And there's just so many ways that we could translate that wine when it comes to how good it is as a subjective perspective. So that kind of brings me to the next question. Of course, if you've got somebody in one of your new classes, which we'll get to in a minute, and they're a new wine learner or somebody just dedicating themselves to a career in wine, what is that one piece of advice that you would give somebody just starting out learning about wine that you wish somebody had offered to you?
I guess the answer I would most readily like to give is the one I have already given when we were talking a little earlier, when I said that, you know, it is so important to keep your personal fresh relationship with wine. That is something I would really urge anybody working with wine to struggle to do. Don't become jaded. Don't settle into the groove. You know, don't get so wise that you know it all. Just keep fresh, keep open, keep sensitive, keep the personal relationship going, keep the discovery going. That's so important. I guess in more practical terms, you know, to anyone who's really contemplating a career in wine, I mean, spending your whole life in that field, then I would say that, you know, it's such an attractive world because, you know, it's half a social choice and half a career choice. People who work in wine find that it you know, it can colonize your social life as well. It's very social. It has that seductive attraction to it. And then, of course, people tend to think in a kind of slightly illogical or emotional way about it. I would say also it's very important to try, you know, to remember that you do need to earn a living from it. And, you know, you have to think very carefully about where the earnings are going to come from. Money isn't everything, of course, but it makes a lot of difference to the texture of your life. You know, I rather naively assume when I started out that if you were good at what you did, you'd earn a decent living and maybe better than that. But with wine writing, that's, you know, it's really not true at all. To the extent I would say that you can't really raise a family on a wine writing income alone. It's just not possible. You have to do a bunch of other things, which is what I do and I enjoy doing. So that's a difficult side of things. I think wine retail can also be quite difficult in terms of making a good living. Whereas if you can get into importing or broking wines, if you do that well, you can make a very good living. Of course, a lot of people want to make wine themselves. That's a fantastic vocation, superior in many ways to writing about it. And it can mean almost anything. You can have a real struggle of a life, or you can have a fantastic and well-remunerated career depending on exactly, you know, where you slot into the winemaking world. And I think the same is really true for sommelier too. Everything really depends on where you fetch up and the kind of scope you have. But I would say in a practical sense, you know, do think quite carefully about that when you go into it, because, you know, a little careful thought at the beginning of your career can really pay dividends later.
Absolutely. And I think that's great advice. So what I want to do now is just kind of bring it home, if you will, to the new Loire Master Level course that's being launched later this fall. And I'm hoping that you'll give the listeners a little sneak peek at the newly redesigned course.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it's been 2 years in the making. So a lot of thought has gone into this. It's being headed up by Pascaline Lepelletier, a fantastic sommelier, 2018 Best French Sommelier. Many Wine Scholar Guild people will already be familiar with her because she's led tours and so on in the Loire. So she's going to lead it up. I'm sure she'll do an absolutely fantastic job. You've also got Chris Kissack, who's up on the web as the Wine Doctor. He's a great Loire expert and aficionado. You can learn a lot from Chris. You've got Jim Budd, my old friend Jim Budd, another great Loire expert and long-term semi-Loire resident. He has a house there and he's often spending time there. You've got Benoit Roumet, who's the head of the Centre Loire Interprofessional Office. Now here's something that'll be really interesting for everybody to listen to. You've got Nicolas Joly giving a webinar on biodynamics in the Loire. Have you ever had a chat to Nicolas Joly, Val, ever?
I have not. No.
Okay. Well, he's a controversial figure. Not everybody agrees 100% with his approach. But I can tell you he's an absolutely fantastic speaker. And you couldn't really have a better or more committed evangelist for the cause than Nicolas Joly. So that'll be a hugely stimulating webinar. And then you've also got Joe Landron and Muscadet, and a few more to be confirmed too. I think, you know, we haven't quite worked it out the details yet, but I think I'll be doing something as well at some point. So, yeah, a lot to look forward to.
Well, I think what I'm really interested in is a lot of people don't reach for the Loire on the shelves when they walk in to the wine shop. And I actually do a little part-time retail, and I've watched this myself. It's like most people don't go right to the Loire. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's not, I'm not going to use the word underrated, but, you know, what are the strengths and perhaps the weaknesses that you want to bring into focus with the Loire, with this master level program, and how to expand the reach of these wines from this very diverse region?
Well, yeah, you've said it, very diverse. Absolutely, that's it. I mean, I think that has been a bit of a handicap for the Loire in the past. It's so diverse. Almost the only wine style it doesn't make somewhere or another is fortified wine, but it makes just about every other wine style you can think of. So it's a complicated region to get your head round. It's a very northerly region, septentrional, as the French say, and sometimes some of the parts of it have you know, severe climatic challenges in certain vintages. And so if you're a lover of you know, rich and generous wines, for example, you might, you know, just have passed it by. But I think, you know, both of those factors are now becoming real plus points for the Loire. You know, the more people get into wine, and particularly French wine, you know, the more they want to discover all this intricacy and nuance, the more they want to, you know, taste those finely differentiated nuances and terroir and so on. And the Loire is a fantastic region for that, partly because it is so northerly. It's beyond any shadow of a doubt that the more northerly the wine region, the more the exact nuances of terroir really count, the more you can tell the difference between this particular vineyard and that particular vineyard based on the fact that this one is full south facing, whereas that one might be, you know, west facing or northwest facing. So all of those things are really accentuated in the Loire. And then also global warming is underway, for better or worse. I mean, for the planet, it'll probably be for the worse, but occasionally it can be for the better, and the Loire is one of those regions which is probably benefiting from the kind of things that are happening with global warming. Not always, because you can also get wild weather, you can get, you know, the crazy frost outbreak or hailstorm or whatever. But in general, vintages are getting warmer, and that's really playing into the Loire's court in terms of the quality of the wine getting better and better all the time. I was recently down here in Montpellier. I went to Millésime Bio, the the organic wine exhibition, and I was tasting some Loire Reds from 2017, just freshly into bottle, some of them. And, you know, the quality of those was really fantastic. The old thing one used to dread with Loire Reds of, you know, excess grassiness and herbaceousness and skinniness wasn't in evidence at all. These were just wonderful, voluptuous, exuberant, energetic, enticing Cabernet Franc-based reds. So, you know, in a vintage like that, you can really see that although global warming is going to present us with huge challenges on many, many fronts, just once in a while, something good can come from it.
You know, this isn't actually part of what I was going to ask you, but it made me think about the rise in the popularity of rosé and all the different styles of rosé that comes from the Loire. And do you think that could have a hand in increasing the popularity of the region as well?
Yes. You know, one of the wines I cut my teeth on was Rosé d'Anjou. I remember that very well from my early buying days. And it's a wonderful wine for bringing people into the wine world. But of course, you've got a huge range of other roses of all sorts of different styles and nuances and drynesses and so on. So yes, I mean, that's certainly a possibility. And also, we should say that, you know, if you are feeling a little bit jaded with the very ubiquitous Provençal style of rosé, and you want a French contrast to that, you couldn't really pick a greater French contrast than some of the roses of the Loire. So that could play a role too. I would also mention Chenin Blanc, because Chenin Blanc is an absolutely fantastic grape variety. And anybody who loves Chenin Blanc, really, you have to go to the Loire to really understand all the different things it can do. And it can do so many different things, an immensely rewarding grape variety. So that's something else. And then, of course, if you love Sauvignon Blanc, and in the end, you know, we don't like to admit it, but we all do love Sauvignon Blanc when it's really good. And where is it really good? Sancerre and Puy-Fumé. Fantastic. So again, the Loire has another terrific trump card there.
Yep. And don't forget the bubbles.
And don't forget the bubbles.
Cremant. I think that is a great place to leave it, Andrew. Thank you so much for talking to us today about learning, about writing, about the wine business, about the Loire and all these wonderful things. And listeners, for more information, you can go to thewinescholarguild.org and be sure to check out the new Master Level Loire course launching in fall 2019. Thanks, Andrew.
My pleasure.